negotiations of the ceasefire deal with Lebanon. Sheikh Naim Qasem warned that the resistance group's patience has limits.
Everything has a limit. Don't take what we say lightly. Be aware that this resistance is present and it is committed at this time to the agreement. However, if Israel doesn't commit at all, and if the Lebanese state isn't able to bring about the necessary results or the required results politically, we would hence have no such choice to resort to other options.
Sheikh Naim Qasem urged Lebanon's government to enforce the agreement and put an end to the Israeli regime's relentless and blatant violations. He stressed that Hezbollah remains committed to the ceasefire agreement but is ready to defend Lebanon if diplomacy fails. The Hezbollah leader accused Israel of pursuing expansionist goals, citing its unrelenting strikes and illegal presence in Lebanon. He was speaking on the occasion of the International Quds Day. Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that this is a day for confronting oppression everywhere and standing in solidarity with Palestine and all the oppressed people around the world. Israel's latest strikes have claimed the lives of over 24 civilians and left many others injured across the besieged Gaza Strip. One of the latest attacks killed 3 Palestinians and injured several others after Israeli boats targeted the vicinity of the Al-Nur Mosque west of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. 6 Palestinians, including 3 women, were killed and many others injured in northern Gaza Strip. In the southern city of Rafah, an Israeli drone strike killed a 9-year-old child and injured 5 others, mostly children. Another drone strike hit a house in Rafah, killing an 8-year-old child and injuring his mother and sister. 6 civilians were also killed when an Israeli airstrike targeted a house east of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. An Israeli airstrike on a Palestinian home in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, caused fatalities and injuries. The death toll from the regime's genocide is now near 50,300, with over 114,000 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier to provide us with the latest updates on the Israeli attacks across the blockaded territory. Let's take a listen.
The death toll of the Palestinian people being slaughtered since dawn hours till this moment has risen to 24 Palestinian civilians after the Israeli occupation forces committed another massacre in Deir al-Balah city by killing 3 Palestinian civilians. Those people were killed while they were taken and having their iftar meal in the western part of Deir al-Balah city. Their makeshift tent was hit deliberately by the Israeli fighter jets, and they have been brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital as small pieces, revealing how brutal the attack was. And as you know, the Israeli retaliation is still maintained against various parts of Gaza Strip, and it is really intensified right now against the western part of Rafah City, whereas, as you know, the people there are still stranded in Tal al-Sultan neighborhood and the Saudi village for more than a week, and they are still exposed to the relentless Israeli bombardments, attacks, and the gunfire. Hundreds of the Palestinian families are still appealing for having, as you know, an access to the basic humanitarian essentials amid the ongoing blockade imposed by the Israeli occupation forces, while the Israeli artillery shelling also is still maintained against several parts of the northern section of Gaza, so basically Beit Lahia city. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces on the ground detonated several essential buildings in Beit Lahia city, and we are still hearing the Israeli fighter drones are still flying at low levels in all areas of Gaza.
An amusement park that was once a place of celebration is now surrounded by displacement tents in Gaza. Our correspondent Ahmed Al-Najjar visited the site and spoke to locals. They shared their grief, saying that the Israeli regime has stolen their happiness and left them homeless during the time they should be celebrating in the warmth of their homes.
Here in Al-Mawasi area in western Khan Yunis is one of the few amusement parks across the Gaza Strip, a place that once represented joy and celebratory moments for children and their families who are welcoming Eid after the end of the holy month of Ramadan. This place, that was once vibrant with children and their families, the echoing of their laughter as they are riding these games, that are now standing idle, surrounded by hundreds of tents that were constructed by the Palestinian families who were forced out of their towns and were forced into endless cycles of displacement for more than a year now. These tents are now overshadowing this scene of having these games and joy for children.
This park used to be a reminder of fun and joyful times for families. For 2 years now, the occupation has stolen our happiness, depriving us of all our special celebrations. It's Eid, a time when we should be baking cookies and decorating our homes, but instead, we are homeless. Happiness has become an impossible wish these days.
This amusement park was filled with green spaces to receive the families in such special occasions. But what really gave this park its joyful aspect is the existence of many of the games, like the Ferris wheel, the pirate ships, the roller coaster, and all our modest games. But today, as the families are welcoming the Eid, these games stand idle. There's no way to power them because the families can barely find and secure their basic humanitarian needs. And now all these games are surrounded by this miserable scenes of tents, of displacement and suffering.
As we welcome Eid, all we wish for is for this genocide to end. For a year, we have been away from our homes, sheltering in a place we never imagined we'd be. We once brought our children here to celebrate and have fun on this special day, but now we can't even get them with new clothes or offer them safety.
For the second year in a row, the Palestinians across the Gaza Strip welcome the festive Eid al-Fitr with nothing but more miseries and suffering. This place that should be filled with the laughters of children is now covered and overshadowed by the miserable scene of displacement that doesn't seem to end any soon for the families here. Ahmed al-Najjar, Al-Mawasi.
A senior Hamas official says the movement has agreed to a new Gaza ceasefire proposal offered by mediators and is awaiting the Israeli regime's response. In a televised speech, Khalil al-Hayya said Hamas has responded positively and responsibly to the new proposal. Hayya expressed hope that the occupying regime would not obstruct the proposal and thwart the mediators' efforts. Hayya, however, stressed that the resistance's weapon is a red line because it is linked to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. He noted that the resistance would not accept any deal that would involve the expulsion and displacement of Palestinians from their land. He said the cabinet of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to stall and prevent the realization of a ceasefire agreement. Hayya said Netanyahu is trying to prolong the war on Gaza to ensure the survival of his cabinet for as long as possible. He said Netanyahu understands that the survival of his cabinet depends on the continuation of the Gaza war. Author and political analyst Eve Ongler believes that Israel cannot be trusted with any deals and the international community must pressure the regime to uphold its side of the Gaza truce.
There's no reason to trust Israel. The people, you know, Katz was pretty straightforward a few days ago now, I guess a week ago maybe, about their genocidal intent. They want to kill and they want to kill. They want to drive everyone out. And the ceasefire is obviously an impediment in doing that, and so you know, shouldn't be trusted. Now, you know, what's the alternative, though? Unfortunately, from Hamas's perspective, they've been agreeing to the previous proposal that was supposed to go to round two, and Israel's, you know, avoiding. But it's a matter of international pressure. And that's not easy to organize when you have this administration in Washington that is totally fanatical in their hostility to Palestinians. So you don't trust Israel. You have to keep putting pressure, and obviously part of, you know, from Hamas's perspective, Part of the pressure is being able to respond militarily. And then for those of us who are not in Gaza, who are, you know, international, you know, in, here in Canada, is to put pressure on my government, which just, you know, it just came out that they approved $80 million arms. They claim to have stopped arms transfers, but they just approved an $80 million contract.
Meanwhile, scuffles have broken out in Tel Aviv between Israeli forces and demonstrators who call on the regime to stop attacking Gaza and secure the release of all the captives held there. The protesters denounced the handling of the Gaza war by the cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the repeated violations of the ceasefire deal. They warned that returning to war in Gaza could sacrifice their loved ones, stressing that military pressure cannot save the captives. The protesters also slammed the regime's efforts to dismiss the head of Shin Bet and the Attorney General, who are opposed to Netanyahu. The new rally followed a surge in demonstrations throughout the week across the occupied Palestinian territories. The weekly protests revealed a rising dissent against Netanyahu's cabinet over the resumption of the onslaught on Gaza. Israeli forces have killed and injured more civilians as they press ahead with a violent raid on Palestinian towns and villages across the occupied West Bank. In one of the latest incursions, the regime's forces fatally shot a 22-year-old Palestinian man in the northern West Bank town of Tamun. The man was critically injured by Israeli forces' live fire and was later pronounced dead. His body has been taken away by the regime's forces. Israeli forces also wounded two Palestinians in another raid east of Nablus. Local sources said a child and a young man were injured by Israeli live fire during a raid on the town of Beit Furik. The new fatalities bring to nearly 940 the total number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces across the West Bank since the regime's genocidal war started in Gaza. Our Ramallah correspondent Nika Hamed joined us earlier to bring us up to speed on the latest Israeli crimes across the occupied West Bank. Let's see what she had to say.
The IOF is still raiding Tubas until this moment. And as we have spoken to local resources, they have informed that this raid and this series of raids upon Tamun today marks a very violent attack on the area where it is located to the south of Tubas. The Palestinian Ministry of Health has informed that a Palestinian young man, Ahmed Qasim Bani Oude, was shot, killed by the IOF forces, raiding IOF forces towards Tamun, and his body was detained under the pretense that he was fighting back or resisting the IOF. And of course, this leads to such action by the IOF. This actually adds up to the total detained bodies of the Palestinian martyrs, up to 620. Five Palestinian martyrs who have been in captivity and either in the Israeli refrigerators or in the what is known as the cemeteries of numbers. Of course, this is not the first attack on Tamun. We have seen many attacks upon this small village, but it is indeed a small village. But a great turmoil over there is going on.
A senior Yemeni official has once again reaffirmed the country's continued support for the people of Palestine until the liberation of their sanctities and occupied land. The comment was made by the chairman of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr, which marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. He stressed that Yemen will not stop supporting the Palestinian people and their resistance. Mashat also touched on U.S. aggression against Yemen, saying Washington is attacking Yemen to support Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people. Mashat emphasized that the U.S. aggression will not deter Yemen from supporting Palestine, nor will it weaken the will of the Yemeni people. His remarks came as the United States continued its airstrikes on Yemen. According to the country's media, 9 airstrikes targeted Sa'ada governorate, including Al-Salem and Kataf districts and the eastern part of Sa'ada city, damaging public and private property. American warplanes also carried out several airstrikes on Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Iran's foreign minister says the U.S. attacks on Yemen shows Washington's complicity in Israel's attempts to spread insecurity and stability in the region. Abbas Araghchi was speaking in a meeting with UN Special Envoy to Yemen, Hans Grundberg, in Tehran. The top Iranian diplomat condemned the repeated U.S. attacks on Yemen, which has led to the deaths of civilians and the destruction of the country's infrastructure. Araghchi also criticized the United Nations Security Council's inaction regarding the blatant violations of international law by Israel and the U.S. For his part, the U.S. Special Envoy thanked Iran for his continued support of the U.N.'s efforts towards peace in Yemen. Grundberg reiterated that achieving stability and peace in Yemen is an urgent necessity. With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Ramadan, month of God's banquet. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The blessed month of Ramadan is like a rainfall on a dry desert. It is an exceptional opportunity to saturate the parched deserts of our soul with this enlivening rainfall. Ramadan is the time to get rid of the hustle and bustle of everyday life and join the infinite mercy of God. Let us first listen to Ayah 185 of Surah Baqarah. The month of Ramadan is the one in which the Quran was sent down as guidance to mankind, with manifest proofs of guidance and a criterion. Ramadan has provided the best chance for getting close to God and benefiting from His mercy. It is the month of prayer, supplication, and getting close to the Quran. Stay with us for the 28th episode of this series. In Islam, faith and deed are like the two wings of a bird, which take man to perfection and proximity of God. Faith without deed is like a tree which has branches and leaves but yields no fruit. The Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, besides obligatory prayers, which were ordained to be performed every day, recommended other prayers for Muslims to perform, which would complete the obligatory ones. The Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt used to perform these prayers too. According to the narrations, the recommended prayers, nawafil, plural of nafile, compensate for obligatory ones and illuminate the hearts of the faithful. However, the Prophet says, "The heart is sometimes ready and sometimes not. When it is ready, embark on nafile. If not, be content with obligatory ones." The recommended prayers show our love of God. When man tastes the sweetness of obligatory daily prayers, demonstrates his love of the Lord with nafile, which literally means gift and present. As Imam Reza, peace be upon him, says, perform the nawafil, recommended prayers, carefully and beautifully, and know that they are gifts to the court of God the Great. The midnight prayer is among the nawafil which has emphatically recommended to perform. The midnight prayer has 11 rakats and was obligatory only for the Prophet, although all of the Ahlul Bayt would perform it as an obligation. In addition, the companions of the Ahlul Bayt and infallible Imams used to perform this prayer as a tradition. Moreover, the ulama throughout the history of Islam tried to adhere to this tradition, and it was quite common among great personalities like Imam Khomeini, who didn't forget the midnight prayer even when he was in hospital in the last nights of his life. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, man's nobility depends on midnight prayer. In the prayer for the 28th day of the blessed month of Ramadan, we read, O Allah, amplify my share on this day from its recommended prayers, and honor me on this day by attending to my problems, and make closer on this day my means to approach you from among all means, O one who is not preoccupied with the insistence of those who insist. In this prayer, we first ask God to help us perform recommended prayers. Then we beseech Him to honor us with awareness of His commands. Everyone is obligated to know various religious issues through studying, research, and referring to scholars and ulama. In the third part of today's prayer, we ask God to show us the nearest way to Himself from among the ways. Approaching God means reaching spiritual reality. This is attained through the growth of the spirit and purity of the heart. God said to Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, O Moses, the best way for getting my proximity is chastity and keeping aloof from sin. If one does this, I will place him in my lofty gardens of paradise. Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, also said, our predecessors would say, do not commit such and such sin, but I say, do not even think of it. Then he gave an example. Sin is like fire that burns the house, but thinking of sin is like smoke that blackens the walls. Thinking of sin darkens the heart and makes us distant from God. In the end of today's prayer, we say that God is the one who is not made busy by an individual so that he does not have the time to hear others. Rather, he hears everyone at the same time and he needs no appointment beforehand. Well, dear listeners, now it is time for the prayer which we recite every day. O Allah, indeed, I ask you the best of what you are asked, so give me the best of what you give.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, extra deeds for suhoor and iftar. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to HZ with me, Sister Zainab, here on IB English Radio. And so I've found something in particular that some of you maybe know, many of you maybe know. And this is just some extra deeds. So maybe we can increase our rewards, maybe in sort of unexpected ways. So, for example, there's obviously we all know about Qadr night and that we're meant to recite Surah Al-Qadr that night. But it's also said, so narrations also tell us that if we recite this surah at suhoor and iftar time, we are also given particular rewards that are, in a sense, almost unexpected. At least to me, they were unexpected. And so obviously, so reciting Surah Al-Qadr at suhoor and iftar is especially recommended. So it's been narrated, and I'll just sort of try and read this word for word. Every believer who observes fast and at dawn, so suhoor, and at fast breaking, iftar, recites the Surah Al-Qadr, so the same surah that we recite on the nights of power, during the period of dawn and fast breaking, is like the martyr who is wallowing in his own blood. So, yeah, this is obviously very high, because obviously we often hear about, you know, how can we receive the reward of a martyr, because obviously the reward of the martyr, the status of the martyr is a very unique one. And obviously I'll talk a little bit about this, but yeah, this is not a huge requirement. It's not a big challenge for us to actually do this, observe this reciting. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IB English Radio, and so I'm talking about this extra, not a little thing, but an extra deeds we can do at suhoor and iftar time, which is to recite the very famous surah that we recite on the nights of power, the Surah Al-Qadr. And if we recite them at the times of suhoor and iftar, we will, according to narrations, receive the same reward. We will be treated like the martyr who is wallowing in his own blood. And I'm just going to add in a few things. Obviously, the martyrs, those people who are martyred, you know, obviously their status is so special that, you know, they don't even need the, since they have become pox, so they don't even need the ritual washing of the dead usually receive. So that is how unique and how special their status is. So in a sense, they are martyred. So they might be martyred there, you know, on the earth, in the soil, and that's it. They are ready to, you know, go to Allah, basically, as they are. Nothing else is required. And so obviously to think about that, you know, just through, and obviously I'm not saying that, so obviously that is one aspect of the martyrs, but obviously to receive the reward of the martyrs, and the martyrs have, you know, they have many other, let's say, qualities, and these are extra maybe, but I'll just add them. Obviously we know martyrs can even, they're not even confined to their graves. They can, yeah, they can sort of move around. They are truly alive. But just to, in a sense, receive the status with Allah of the martyr, that surely in itself would be worth considering doing this recitation at suhoor and iftar. So I leave this with you, and also request you to also maybe go and find this narration and read it to yourself again. And think more deeply upon that, and think more deeply upon maybe the Surah Al-Qadr itself, and also the status of all our martyrs. And it would be especially during the holy month of Ramadan to actually be doing all that anyway. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on IB English Radio, and farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. In the limelight. The Atlantic journalist Jeffrey Goldberg was added to a Signal group chat with top Trump officials addressing secret war plans. However, Donald Trump's top intelligence officials claim no classified information was shared in the group chat. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. National broadcaster NBC News has covered the story and tells us more. President Donald Trump's top intelligence officials claimed on Tuesday, 25th of March, that they did not share any classified materials in a group text about U.S. military plans that inadvertently included a journalist. National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe both downplayed the mishap at a contentious Senate Intelligence Committee hearing just a day after The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg reported that he had been added to a text thread about U.S. military plans to strike Houthi targets in Yemen. The incident has raised questions about the Trump administration's handling of classified information, as well as its use of the encrypted messaging application Signal and various other electronic communications. In testimony, CIA Director John Ratcliffe acknowledged he was on the text chain, but said it was lawful. He said the Signal app was loaded on his work computer at the CIA when he started the job and claimed it was permitted as a communication tool for work purposes. He did not address whether it was appropriate to share detailed military plans on the app Signal. Tulsi Gabbard, National Intelligence Director, asked by Democrats whether the timing and location of planned military strikes were shared on the chat, replied, "I can attest to the fact that there were not classified or intelligence equities that were included in that chat group at any time." Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of the magazine, The Atlantic, and a veteran national security journalist, reported that the thread on Signal appeared to include Ratcliffe and Gabbard, as well as Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz. In a Fox News interview on Tuesday night, 25th of March, Mike Waltz said he takes full responsibility for organizing the text group and that a staffer was not to blame for Jeffrey Goldberg's inclusion. Mike Waltz, the national security advisor, said, "I take full responsibility. I built the group. My job is to make sure that everything's coordinated."
The military plan discussed in the group chat included precise information about weapons packages, targets and timing, Jeffrey Goldberg wrote in his article in The Atlantic. He said he would refrain from reporting specific information shared in the chat that could damage America's national security. In an exchange with Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, Tulsi Gabbard says she did not remember discussing specific weapons, targets, and timing. The intelligence officials both testified on Tuesday that Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, was the original classifying authority on the chat. Jeffrey Goldberg, the journalist, reported that one message from a Signal account labeled Pete Hegseth included operational details of forthcoming strikes on Yemen, including information about targets, weapons the U.S. would be deploying, and attack sequencing. CIA Director John Ratcliffe and National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard, responding to a question from Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, said they would cooperate with an audit looking into whether they had used Signal on another messaging platform to discuss classified information. In a statement on Monday, the National Security Council said it was reviewing how an inadvertent number was added to the chain. Tulsi Gabbard would not answer questions about whether she was using her personal phone or her government-issued phone, citing the fact that the Signal issue was under review. FBI Director Kash Patel, one of the other witnesses on Tuesday, said he was briefed on the incident on Monday night and did not say whether he planned to open an investigation into the incident. The hearing frequently grew heated. Democrats asked aggressive questions and accused the witnesses of jeopardizing America's national security. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon said he believes Pete Hegseth and Mike Waltz should resign. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, said, "It was mind-boggling to me that all these senior folks were on this line, and nobody even bothered to check whether a journalist or another unauthorized person was in the chat." Continue with NBC News' coverage of this story. In his opening statement, Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, blasted the Trump administration with what he characterized as a cavalier attitude towards classified information, describing it as reckless and sloppy. "The Signal fiasco is not a one-off," Senator Warner said. "It is unfortunately a pattern we're seeing too often repeated." Senator Warner added, "The unwillingness of the individuals on this panel who were on the chat to even apologize for acknowledging what a colossal screw-up this is speaks volumes." Senator Warner cited an earlier incident in January when the CIA, complying with a presidential executive order, sent an unclassified email to the Office of Personnel Management with the first names and initialized last names of recently hired employees at the spy agency. Senator Michael Bennet, Democrat of Colorado, grilled CIA Director John Ratcliffe about whether Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, was in Moscow when the group chat conversation occurred. Senator Michael Bennet said, "This sloppiness, this incompetence, this disrespect for our intelligence agencies and the personnel who work for him is entirely unacceptable. It's an embarrassment. You need to do better. You definitely need to do better." Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, the chairman of the committee, did not directly address the Signal text chain in his prepared opening remarks. Republican senators largely focused their questions on other issues, including drug cartels and China. Donald Trump, speaking to NBC News by phone on Tuesday, 25th of March, stood by his National Security Advisor Mike Waltz. Jeffrey Goldberg reported that he was added to the Signal chat after he received a request from a user identified as Waltz. Michael Waltz has learnt a lesson, and he's a good man, Donald Trump emphasized. Speaking from the White House in a lengthy back and forth with reporters on Tuesday, Donald Trump downplayed the events and said, "The chat contained no classified information as I understand it." Trump added, "They were using an app, as I understand it, that a lot of people in government use, a lot of people in the media use." Mike Waltz, who was in the room for a meeting of ambassadors, defended himself amid repeated questions about when Donald Trump learned of the chat and how. Mike Waltz said they planned to look into how journalist Jeffrey Goldberg got added to the chat and whether Signal is secure enough to use for high-level discussions. The Fox News Channel has also covered the same story. President Donald Trump is not planning to fire National Security Advisor Mike Waltz in the wake of The Atlantic's reporting of an apparent national security breach, according to Fox News Channel. Donald Trump told Fox News he's not getting fired. The president said the incident was a mistake, though there was nothing important in the Signal text thread. The president described Mike Waltz as a good guy and added that the attack was a success, referring to the U.S. operation against the Houthis in Yemen. A source close to the president previously told Fox News Channel that Mike Waltz's job is safe and that he's not on the chopping block. Mike Waltz has no plans to resign and stuck to his schedule on Tuesday. He talked to his Russian counterpart about a Black Sea ceasefire deal and later on Tuesday spoke to President Trump. Mike Waltz is also telling colleagues that he has never met or talked to the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine, Jeffrey Goldberg. Democrats on the House Armed Services Committee are calling for Mike Waltz's ouster over the national security breach. "This is outrageous national security breach and heads should roll. We need a full investigation and hearing into this on the House Armed Services Committee as soon as possible," according to Representative Chris DeLuzio, Democrat of Pennsylvania. And also Representative Sarah Jacobs, Democrat of California, said, "We can't chalk this up to a simple mistake. People should be fired for this."
We've all heard how pesticides are bad and harmful. You need to clean up the produce, the vegetables and the fruits that come from farms that have pesticides used in them because of the residue that is left on the produce. Not to mention the residue in the soil can seep into the waterbeds and pollute the water there. Or it could even just be absorbed by the next batch of seeds that will be planted in that same area. It could even destroy the ecosystem in the immediate surrounding of where that pesticide was used, to the point that even birds would not even fly in that same direction anymore, and it would just essentially kill all of the ecosystem and significantly harm it at the very least. So that's only some of the reasons why we consider pesticides to have perhaps more downsides than is worth it. But there is a better alternative: using biopesticides or in this particular case, a biofungicide, which is a naturally occurring microorganism that is found within the soil. And at this facility right here, at the Nuclear Agricultural School, they found a way to select that particular microorganism among the billions of others within the soil and multiply it in the lab to get it to an amount that it could actually combat the soil-borne diseases that would otherwise need pesticides to get rid of. So that's exactly what we're going to be focusing in this week's episode of Iran Tech. With me, your host, Ali Reza. Stay tuned. Iran's climate naturally gives way for certain types of soil-borne pathogens that thrive on its mostly hot and dry weather. Namely, we have fusarium-based pathogens, which are, again, soil-borne pathogens that cause much wilt and rot in plants. Over here, we have an example. So this is a sample tomato plant that has been wilted as a result of, this is the mold that is caused by the fusarium, which is, again, a type of pathogen, a soil-borne pathogen that thrives on Iran's climate. So how do we combat this? Because pretty much all farmlands in Iran are plagued with this soil-borne pathogen. So there is an antagonist to this pathogen that can also be found within the same soil. It's a type of microorganism named Trichoderma. It's a type of biofungicide. It's a type of fungi that is naturally occurring. But if we're able to select this particular biofungicide from the billions of microorganisms within 1 cubic centimeter of soil and multiply it on a lab level, we can use it as a preventative slash treatment measure against any fusarium-based pathogen that, like I said, plagues every farmland in Iran. And that's really going to be the focus of this week's episode. We're going to talk about how we can select this one particular type of fungi amidst the billions of microorganisms that you can find with just a single cubic centimeter of soil. So stay tuned to find out more about it.
One of the significant activities in the field of nuclear agriculture is the production of biological materials to control soil-borne diseases. Therefore, we are compelled to move towards using mutation by inducing changes in native strains of the country. Good work has been done in this area. For example, the use of mutation methods to improve the characteristics of native Iranian fungi, such as Trichoderma fungi, which control fusarium diseases. The method of mutation or inducing changes to enhance the properties of native Iranian fungi is aimed at providing an alternative to the chemical pesticides commonly used by farmers and agricultural operators. Thus, the best approach is to replace chemical methods with these activities. Work carried out at the Nuclear Agriculture Research Institute includes the irradiation of Trichoderma fungal species in the country, identifying and isolating higher quality strains with significant antagonistic properties against pathogens. Selection, collection, and ultimately their evaluation in greenhouse and field conditions have been conducted at the Institute over the past years. In collaboration with the Ministry of Agriculture, we have sought to obtain permits for the production of biological fungicides, and fortunately, we have succeeded in registering our own Trichoderma mutants for the first time in the country and obtaining production licenses.
Now let's get some terminology out of the way before we go any further. First, we have mutation as a central idea. Mutation can occur randomly, or it could occur as a result of exposure to extreme heat, extreme cold, certain diseases like we experienced with COVID. There were just some random mutations of it. Each mutation could have different properties. It could be more resilient against cold, heat, or disease. Certain mutations of plants, let's say, are just generally more attractive to farmers than others. And What we want to do is to be able to pick that mutation and multiply it to cover an entire form that is now more resilient to disease, heat, cold, etc., than the form that we originally had with the strand that we originally had. So that's the idea of mutation. And then if we take a look back at the idea that we talked about, the soil being a living thing because it houses billions and billions of microorganisms within it, there are certain microorganisms that act as pathogens, which are agents of disease for the plants. And then we have antagonists to that pathogen, which could be pesticides that we create chemically in a lab that have various harmful effects. But then we have biofungicides as one of the types of microorganisms that naturally occur in that like one cubic centimeter of soil with billions and billions of microorganisms within it. So the idea is to be able to select and pick that one particular type of biofungicide and multiply it within a lab to use it as the antagonist to that pathogen. And this is really the central idea behind the biofungicide of discussion in this week's episode. So we're picking one particular biofungicide. It's called Trichoderma, and we want to pick it from the billions of microorganisms within the soil and multiply it and use it against certain types of pathogen, for example, Fusarium, which is a type of fungi that creates disease within different types of plants. So with that knowledge in mind, now let's take a closer look at the mutation and the relationship between the antagonist and the pathogen.
Iran's agriculture faces a major challenge, Fusarium diseases. These soil-borne fungi attack crops like wheat, tomatoes, and cucumbers, thriving in Iran's warm and irrigated farmlands. But nature has a defender, Trichoderma. In poorly drained or over-irrigated soil, Fusarium fungi invade roots, blocking water and nutrients. The result? Wilting, stunted growth, and devastating crop loss. Farmers often struggle to control these diseases with chemical fungicides, which can harm the environment and lose effectiveness over time. Trichoderma is a beneficial fungus that fights Fusarium in three powerful ways. 1. It attacks and destroys Fusarium directly, feeding on it like a natural enemy. This reduces the fungal population in the soil over time. 2. It produces antifungal compounds that stop Fusarium from growing. These natural chemicals create an environment where harmful fungi struggle to survive. 3. It strengthens plant roots, making them more resistant to infection. Healthier roots mean stronger plants, better yields, and less dependence on chemical treatments. Applying Trichoderma is easy. It comes in granules mixed into the soil or as a liquid sprayed onto roots. Farmers can integrate it into their existing planting and irrigation system with minimal effort. This eco-friendly solution works even in Iran's dry climate, especially in irrigated fields where Fusarium thrives. Unlike chemical fungicides, Trichoderma is a sustainable option that improves soil health and long-term crop productivity.
One of the challenges we face in ensuring food security is controlling the damage caused by plant diseases. Annually, about 10% of agricultural production is lost due to contamination by pests and plant diseases, removing it from the food supply chain. Until now, chemical control methods have predominantly been used to manage the damage caused by pests and diseases. One eco-friendly approach that helps maintain ecosystem balance while ensuring sustainable disease control is biological control, which involves using a biological agent. An antagonist pathogen is the disease-causing agent that inflicts damage on crops. Microbial relationships are divided into two types: antagonism and symbiosis. Symbiotic organisms coexist, while antagonistic organisms oppose each other. We use an antagonist or natural enemy to control the damage caused by a disease or pathogen in a biocontrol method. On a commercial scale, the use of biocontrol methods often lacks popularity among farmers and producers compared to chemical methods. primarily due to the unavailability of effective biocontrol agents. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, through its Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, utilizes gamma radiation-induced mutation to enhance the antagonistic capabilities of these biocontrol agents. One well-known antagonist is the Trichoderma fungus. Trichoderma can naturally control a wide range of plant pathogens and diseases. However, to effectively use Trichoderma in managing plant disease damage, we need strains with high efficiency. Here, you can see an image of spores from a native strain of Ganoderma fungus isolated from soils in our country. When Trichoderma spores are exposed to gamma radiation, they may undergo genetic changes. Those genetic changes that increase the antagonistic power of Trichoderma are identified and isolated as desirable mutations by experts in microbiology laboratories. After exposing Trichoderma spores to gamma radiation, the DNA of the spores may undergo mutations under various scenarios. These scenarios could include nucleotide changes, such as inversion, translocation, or substitution. Each of these mutations can lead to new phenotypes and genotypes in the genetics of Trichoderma. To screen or select mutant strains resulting from gamma radiation, we utilize genetic markers based on the amplification of specific genomic regions or protein markers.
In the past year and a half that this lab has been working on producing this biofungicide, it has managed to produce roughly 3.5 tons of effective agent. Because as you know, any type of drug has an effective agent and a lot of carrier. In this case, the carrier makes up the vast majority of the weight, which has amounted to 35 tons of pesticides not being imported into the country because, you know, the most common, most accessible way of dealing with this fusarium-based pathogens has been to just use pesticide, which we've already talked about just how many negative effects it can have on the soil, the environment as a whole, and on the farmers who are using these pesticides. So it has prevented the use of 35 tons of pesticide, and it has been able to do that with the same amount of effectiveness as a pesticide. So with the reduced cost of making it, there's really no reason to go back to using pesticides. So hopefully they keep doing what they're doing and be able to cover more ground when it comes to soil-borne diseases, if there is any left. And with that said, I think that's going to be it for this week's episode of Iran Tech. I'll see you guys next week.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali baytihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Brothers, sisters, listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi. We were discussing scholars. We have a hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. He says, من عمل على غير علم كان ما يفسد أكثر مما يصلح. He said, when it comes to those who are scholarly and those who work without knowledge, sometimes a person is ignorant himself and he doesn't know what he's doing, and whatever he does,